I'm Giuseppe Gabusi and I teach international political economy and political economy of East Asia at the University of Torino, Italy, and international relations of East Asia at the Catholic University of Milan. My focus being mostly on China and China's political economy and relations with the neighborhood. The first topic we can comment on is the new relationship between China and the rest of Asia, especially Southeast Asia, and we can look at the American reaction to the new Chinese dynamism in the region, in a way. Of course, China has been very active lately in the region, and China has signed a free trade agreement with ASEAN, with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The new administration, the Obama administration, replied to this activism, especially last year, with a trip to Asia of the president, there was this kind of relaunch of the American presence in Asia, which is called the U.S., as you know, the U.S. pivot to Asia. Hillary Clinton in 2009 in Thailand said the United States is back, as if it were a kind of as if it were absent during the Bush presidency. In a way, this is a challenge, I think, especially for the Southeast Asian nations, because in a way they have a double loyalty. They have an economic loyalty towards China. Of course, their economy is more and more integrated within the global chain of production, which is centered in China, and their economic welfare of course depends more and more from this relationship with China. But as we know, history tells us that these countries do not trust 100% China. And their security is, in a way, guaranteed historically for most of the region by the American presence in the Pacific. So they have this double loyalty, and things are getting even more complicated since, in a way, Barack Obama tried to propose as a possible alternative picture in the region, to propose a new free trade area which basically does not include China, and starting from a framework which already exists but involves just a tiny absolute terms, tiny economies like Singapore, for instance, and especially the idea to have a military presence in Darwin in Australia is complicating things even further. In a way, this is a pressure that the Southeast Asian countries have to deal with, my fear, so to say, is that if they do not deepen their integration within the ASEAN as a structure, first of all, the regional grouping as such, ASEAN, will be condemned to irrelevance in a way, so it's probably going to be framework to have some nice summits during the year and have some photo opportunities with the leaders of the region. Maybe, of course, it's interesting in terms of trade, but nothing more. Not a a security organization, and of course not something similar to the European Union, which of course had a pooling of sovereignty of member states. And secondly, this double pressure is very strong. These states are quite weak, so they will be basically dependent on activities and decisions taken in Beijing or in Washington, D.C. So the area is again one of the most critical in security terms in the world, and I don't see this economic involvement between China and the ASEAN countries as a way to improve also the security relations. Of course, the war and the global or regional, at least the regional war, is not behind the corner, I think, and they can manage to deal with single skirmishes, but of course their position is very, very delicate. On China's manipulating its currency, of course it's a very sensitive issue, and I think especially in an year where the American electorate is going to vote for a new president, this is even more sensitive. There are some studies saying that probably the renminbi, the Chinese currency, the yuan, is undervalued. Some say is between 20% and 30%, which is quite a figure, of course. But in order to have the official consequences of a trade reactions against a country which is manipulating the currency, first we have to declare the country as a manipulator. So Mitt Romney said that the first thing that he will be doing if and when elected will be to declare China as a manipulator in a way. So you can see really the nexus, the link between the American electoral process and foreign policy and the financial situation regarding the renminbi in a way. So this is the first thing to keep in mind. Beware of the slogans. Beware of the political manipulation of this situation. I'm saying this because I personally think that China is not manipulating its currency, or at least it's not manipulating the currency to the point that you can really define China as a currency manipulator in this sense. Meaning that, of course, the Chinese government has clearly said that renminbi will probably be a fully convertible currency in 3-4 years' time, like something like 2015. These are the official positions of the Chinese government. But as always, when it comes to China needs time, needs to gradually change its economic system, its financial system, in order to cope with the challenge coming from the fact that your country is will be now, in the future, fully integrated within the global financial system. First of all, you have to change the economic structure of production, which is to direct this production more towards this internal consumption and less towards export. And it's not easy. It's not something that you can do overnight because tastes are different, prices are different, the entire structure of logistics, for example, is very different. So first, they need time, even though they know that they must rebalance the economy towards internal consumption. That's why, if you look at the currency exchange rate between the American dollars and the RMB, you can see that slowly but steadily, at least from 2010, the RMB is gaining value, is gradually being revalued. So, can you really say that China is manipulating this currency when you see at least the value of RMB gradually moving upwards in a way? And secondly, of course, you have to think that if the RMB is to become to become fully convertible, you need to abolish the checks on capital movement, like capital movement controls. You have to get this flow of money coming back and forward very very freely in a way, and this is of course very very important. Also, finally on this point, I would also say that the Chinese government is probably growing more fearful of this so-called hot money, which is coming into the country, betting on first the appreciation, the continuous appreciation of the currency, and secondly on the RMB becoming fully convertible. So it means I invest now in China in RMB because the value is low, and if the value is going to go up as it has done in the last few years, of course I'm going to profit, to make money, and I can just send money abroad if and when these capital controls will be abolished, will be scratched. So the final comment is that the topic is really hot, and the issue is more complicated than it appears, and it's not a case that it's used in the electoral process in America. Some comments on the idea that China is threatening the liberal democratic order that was set in place at the end of World War II under the American hegemony, of course. In my view, I think that China is not directly challenging the liberal economic order because, as some academic has correctly said, China is a kind of stakeholder of the system. They have an interest in the continuation of this liberal economic order. They benefited a lot from globalization, and they proved people like Susan Strange, who was an academic writing on these issues, which means that China proves that you can take profit of the globalization, while in the meantime reinforcing your national power and your very existence as a state. So globalization not necessarily is something that weakens the state. They both manage to join the WTO while allowing China to be back. To be back on the international stage as a great power, as a great power ready to make its decisions more strongly respected by the international community. And as you can see, for instance, when it comes to WTO, China not only now is the target of like anti-dumping procedures, but China has learned how to use these mechanisms which are granted by WTO. And so when it's necessary, China is ready to go to the WTO panels and tribunals and sue other countries, precisely as the West is doing with China. And not only the West, India is the most active country targeting China for anti-dumping processes or measures. Of course, this is not to say that things can stay on like they were before. It's not, of course, the 50s anymore, it's not the 70s, but it's not even the 90s. The financial crisis we all are in after 2007-2008 is, in a way, undermining the plausibility of the liberal democratic order, at least when it comes to the Washington Consensus prescriptions, which of course we have as a legacy from the 80s, and the idea that states and markets are completely separate, and they need to be separate because you have to give free hand to the market and things will be sorted out and the equilibrium will follow as a kind of magic in a way. This is a weakening aspects of the liberal consensus built around the United States. And in fact, since the famous paper written by Joseph Ramo in 2004, there is now this talk of the Beijing consensus, which means that probably mainly developing countries, but even our democracies, can think of possible alternatives, and one of these possible alternatives is the one based on the experience in China. The Beijing consensus is not very well defined, as I can see it, but there is this broad idea that authoritarian states can work better when it comes to development, when it comes to granting an economy some space to take off, finally. And of course, the European Union, the United States have spent tons and tons of money in Africa. And what are the results? You can see the sub-Saharan African region is probably the poorest in the world. And of course, we put many conditionalities, like the conditionalities we are used in the World Bank and IMF projects. You have to respect human rights, and you have to go democratic, you have to respect minorities, this kind of things. And China comes and says to these countries, look, I'm not giving you any conditionality, I'm giving you some help, financial help. I just want to help you and to build the infrastructure. So it's very convenient for the African governments to go to Beijing and to get some money basically at no condition. We see there are some kind of conditions, but not in the sense that we are used in the liberal international liberal framework in a way. So in my view, the Beijing consensus is not there because we have the idea that China has developed a new model of development, as I have been writing in some papers and in a book. I think that basically China has simply learned some lessons from history, and especially from the rise of capitalism. When economies take off, they become capitalist, and they take off, they become capitalist in a way which is not the way that is portrayed in the Washington Consensus. Capitalism is something different from simply markets. In capitalism, historically, states and markets work together. Look at Japan, for instance, look at Taiwan, look at Korea, look at other countries in East Asia. And of course, this is not going to last forever, as we saw in Korea, and we probably also are seeing in Japan. But at least at the takeoff stage, you have to think of capitalism. And capitalism has different varieties. There is a French capitalism, an Italian capitalism, a Anglo-Saxon capitalism, a German capitalism, and of course a Chinese capitalism. History matters, as the post-Washington Consensus would say, and if history matters, it means that there are different conditions under which states and markets can work together to go towards economic development in a capitalist basically way, because China, of course, the Chinese government will never say that they are capitalists, but the structure of the incentive is a capitalist structure. China and Africa is another topic which has been in the media in the last 5 or 6 years, at least. And, you know, you have these big titles on China's new colonialism in Africa, China exploiting Africa, and so on. Of course, as we were saying before, China is going to Africa to have some benefits for its own economy. They are going there basically for resources. Oil is for sure the most important resource we can think of. Look at Sudan, look at Angola. Copper in Zambia is another resource, for instance. And they practice this kind of barter in a way. So they buy oil, but they don't often pay in cash, but they go and build hospitals, they build roads, they build government buildings. They recently inaugurated the African Union headquarters, the new headquarters in Addis Abeba. So this is very much the way they act in China. So there are also, of course, many problems when it comes to the exploitation of resources. Sometimes Chinese companies go there and they bring with them Chinese workmen, and so they don't really benefit the locals and the local economy. So there is this fear. We have seen also some riots, for instance, in Zambia. But the second reason to be in Africa, I think, especially after the Arab Spring, is to be on the southern shore of the Mediterranean, so in northern Africa, and to use presence in these countries as a kind of economic platform towards the European market. They are very, very pragmatic. They, after the collapse of the Tunisian regime and the ousting of Mubarak, they were in Cairo, they were in Tunis, basically saying, we respect the will of the people, we were working with the previous government, and of course we are working also and will be working with the new government, and they are kind of experimenting like special investment zones to manufacture goods, to sell to the European market, which is of course much closer than is much closer from Tunisia and Egypt than from China. So the reasons are clear. Some would say that even the French intervention in Libya was a kind of signal to China and other non-European powers to mind their own business, like to say, this is our own courtyard, and it's kind of European moral doctrine in a way. Maybe, why not? And in fact, when NATO started to send bombs to Libya, we were seeing the Chinese Navy coming and taking away all the Chinese people living in Libya, which means that China was already there. Even it was not on the media, in the media, but it was a strong presence, and so why not? It's fascinating. I'm not 100% sure, but it's something to consider. It's something to consider when you look at the African, Chinese-African game. So, in the end, the big question, we all know that, the big question is the power shift to Asia. Is America declining? Is China's rising kind of threat to the liberal economic order? Where are we going from now? I think first, we should not be too much excited, because I would say this is really nothing news. The debate on the American decline is something which is going on since the early 70s, since the Nixon shocks. Of course, the Chinese would say history means that sometimes powers rise, sometimes powers decline. Look at history, and the United States is not any different. It's not the eternal superpower. The second thing is that I would say that even though the economic power is shifting to Asia, the American and the European soft power, lifestyle, the idea to be able to speak freely is something which has a stronger appeal than any version of the Beijing consensus, in a way. And even the United States has many resources to use to reinvent itself. Of course, they cannot be back to the super hegemony of the 50s. We have to have in mind that the glorious days of the West are probably over, and sometimes I would say maybe this is even better. Look at what the French colonial powers and the British colonial powers have done in the rest of the world. Something good, something very, very bad, something terribly bad. So do not do any finger pointing at China, because everyone has its own skeletons in the cupboard, in a way. Look at the French in Africa, for instance, in the last 30 or 40 years, is something you don't always think of. Of course, we have to count to the understanding that the world will be a more complex place to rule. Complexities will add on and on. There is not only China, but there are many other countries, Indonesia, India, of course, South Africa, Brazil, Turkey. Look at Turkey. Europe doesn't want Turkey. Turkey goes somewhere else. First flight to Tripoli, Libya, after the war, was a Turkish airline flight. So this is dangerous. The risk is that if every country goes its own way, the multilateral system will become basically irrelevant and could not work anymore. Look at the stalemate in the WTO. Look at the WTO Doha round stalemate, which is, this is precisely due to the fact that everyone is trying and signing bilateral free trade agreements with everyone in the world, not only China, but even the Americans and even the European Union nowadays. And I'm not sure that the multipolar world, which is coming to birth, is really a place, a more secure place to live in. There is also an opportunity, especially after the Great Recession, and we'll see also if the euro will survive. The opportunity is to look at our own mistakes and to rethink our liberal tradition beyond the slogans that we are used to since, I would say, the neoliberal agenda of President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher in the 80s. The idea is that China is forcing us to take into consideration alternatives, to think something new. I would say, just imagine a world where the global political economy is based on idea developed by Chinese economists in Beijing and not by American economists in Chicago or Wall Street traders in New York. Just think of it. Of course it's going to be a different world, because it's not just the Confucius story, and so on. It's that the Chinese world is a different world. It's something which has taken some ideas from us, has absorbed some technical instruments when it comes to markets, to finance, and so on. But it doesn't mean that they are like us, and they cannot be like us, as we cannot be like the Chinese. So maybe that there's a way to find some new common ground in this global political economy agenda, and to, in a way, recognize that even the West has made some mistakes. Even the West is not perfect, and that the market is something different from the caricature of itself, which is portrayed in the consensus. Even Adam Smith has been read under the slogan of the free hand, the curative role of the market. Just read the Theory of Moral Sentiments, for instance, which is another work by Adam Smith, which says something really different, which is not something that Reagan would have subscribed to. Finally, this is, I think, easier to see if you are an academic from Europe, and even though you are in the West, and you are in the Western community, of course there are some differences between Europe and the United States when it comes to perceptions, when it comes to the idea of social democracy, when it comes to the idea of states taking care of its own citizens in a way. In Europe, most of my fellow countrymen and most of Europeans really cannot understand the debate on the Earth reform, the Obamacare law, which means, of course, we believe in freedom, but we are not libertarians as the Tea Party movement followers, in a way. So, if you are free to die, because you have not money to pay your own insurance, is something that Europeans would not accept, for instance. So even within the Western community, there is some space to rethink. And the sooner we do that, the better, because as you can see in Greece, and you can see in other parties, even in France with Marine Le Pen, you see that the ghosts of the past are still there, and it's just really a little step to go from democracy to some forms of authoritarian states, which are not necessarily dictatorships, but are really something different from the democracy, the democratic institutions that we are accustomed to, we are used to. And with all these countries like Russia, like China, which, by the way, it's not the case, are very present in Greece, in investments, reviving old historical links, like using the Orthodox Church with the Russians. It's not the case that these powers, which are the champions of the state capitalism, which seems to be rising all over the world, it's not the case that they seem to take great profit from this situation. So the idea to rethink ourselves and to reframe ourselves without giving up our identities and our ideas, I think is the only way to face the challenge of the 21st century, which is a challenge of a world which is not based on the West anymore.